You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 458 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you in separate locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Thank God you're not in Spokane anymore.
You know, I wish we had at least saved the intro to last week's pod, in which at least four times I attempted to say Spokane, Washington, home of Gonzaga. And the subsequent silence, a combination of your anger about that and the fact that my connection was so bad that you couldn't tell whether I had stopped talking or not. Alas, we were not able to deliver the promised pod last weekend. So it's going to be, you know, you love the oops all. You know what this is?
What is this?
This is Double Stuff Podcast.
Oh, wow. I love it. Maybe mega stuff, if we're being honest.
Oh, there's a lot going on. And I feel like there are two news stories where it's like I need to explain things to you and through that, hopefully, the listener. Stories. I don't know if that's how you feel about this, but we'll see when we get there.
And wait, what?
And of course, the Mariners have started playing. Well, just like there's two news stories, the things that are in the news about basketball that I have insight on.
Okay.
I would hope. So, all right. Well, we start with quick toast this week. A congrats to Chelsea Hallinan, Emily Innes, Mary McDonough, and Taylor Rusan, who advanced to the NCAA Gymnastics Tournament from the Huskies Gym Dogs. UW will host the Seattle Regional, encompassing the first three rounds of the competition, starting on Thursday.
All right. We do it all.
We do. I was looking hard for a test this week. But with that, let's get into our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
There we go. Because we've had... I thought you were going to say it's Mariners hot takes already.
No, this is ahead on the I don't want to say the rundown because that has a specific connotation now on the run of show. A lot of NBA news has happened since we last talked, starting with the Boston Celtics. Oh, I guess we had already talked about the Boston Celtics being sold. We also have another sale going on here. We pretty much knew this was happening, but now it's official. The Minnesota Timberwolves will be sold in their entirety to a group, including 25% Seattle sports figure of the year.
There we go.
Alex Rodriguez.
I'm giving him a retroactive 1996 sports figure of the year. Is that okay?
Wow. I mean,
would he not have been?
I think he would have been. I did the past ones at one point. I can dig
although,
up.
So the Sonics were in the finals, 95. It had to have been. It was going to be a Sonic then.
It was probably Gary Payton, I would say. I can't. I'll go look for this as we're talking. But there was, in fact, a Board of Governors meeting last week in the NBA. No update on expansion, no progress on expansion. The main talking point coming out of that was the NBA working on the NBA Europe League that they announced in conjunction with FIBA. But we did have multiple questions for Adam Silver afterwards about expansion. So we'll get those in a second. I had Sean Kemp also considered Gary Payton and Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez won it in 97.
97, okay.
In 95 my retroactive ones. I already closed the file, but
it was Griffey. Surely. You don't have to.
Surely like, it was Griffey.
Yeah.
Well, no, Griffey won it in 93 with the eight homers in a row. So in 1995, I gave it to Edgar Martinez.
Edgar, yeah, for the double. Okay.
Randy Johnson did not win this award in a retroactive.
Who won 94? Was that like
94 was the strike season, so it wasn't going to be any of the Mariners.
No, no,
and
I'm
Griffey
saying...
had already won. And it wasn't any of the Sonics. I don't know if you remember what happened in 1994, so I gave it to Napoleon Kauffman.
Hello. There we go.
Gary did not win it in this until 1998. Probably part of it was, like, if I'm doing it retroactively, I know that Gary Payton is still going to be around after any of these Mariners. So,
can you imagine a time when we have so many good players playing in Seattle that, like, all of those players that you just mentioned, right now I'm like, you the fan? I'm like, Victor Robles had like a pretty good summer.
Some of us saved Julio just in case. Jorge Polanco.
How long are we saving Julio for?
Oh, no. Look,
Good God.
Anyways.
I don't even, I rewarded it to, I think, Damon Williams this year.
You haven't awarded it to anyone yet, but.
But I'm saying the most recent one,
oh,
2024.
Yeah. Not Jed Fish?
I think I awarded it more to Damon. I don't even remember. If only we had the hindsight of it being 25 years later.
we'll know a lot more about Damon Williams and Jed Fish's career in 25 years.
Yes.
Anyways, after the press conference, okay, Adam Silver, let's go through the questions. First off, you said in September that at some point during the year, the plan was to address expansion here in the NBA. With the Celtics sale agreed to last week, with the TV deal done, with the CBA done, I was curious if there was any realistic timeline on when the vetting process for expansion would be getting underway. Here's Adam Silver's response. So the short answer is no new developments, but I would only say in terms of looking at this year, I think we're still in the process of digesting the Celtics transaction. There's no doubt that a major transaction like that becomes relevant to expansion. That deal has just been presented to us. We're still analyzing it. My sense is once we've been through that process that we'll turn to it in a more serious way. The league office has continued to model what potential expansion could look like over the last year or so. And again, that included both understanding dilution from an economic standpoint. We now have a better understanding of that now that we have our national TV deals in place, and also from a player standpoint. This was the interesting part. I just add the last component, which is also is giving me just a bit of pause, is that we'd like to have a better sense of where we're going with local media. Bill Koenig is here, our head of media. He made a fairly lengthy presentation to the board on that. It's well known that we've seen some significant declines there. Virtually two-thirds of our teams are now dealing with RSNs that recently experienced bankruptcies or have shut down. I think while we understand the national media landscape now, to the extent that we're looking at expansion domestically, I think we'd really like to understand what that opportunity for local media is, because it's a pretty critical component of our team's economics. So that's not a great sign. It's not the worst sign.
How much are we going through here before we're going to talk about this?
Well, there's one more question.
Okay, let's do that. I guess, what is the next question?
So the next question was, friend of the pod, Tim Booth of the Seattle Times was there in person, and he asked, for fans who have kind of ridden the peaks and valleys of this expansion conversation, at this point, what is kind of what you see as a viable timeline for how this is going to play out, being that you originally had thought that it was going to be addressed before the end of the season? And with that, what's your message to fans in those cities that have been talked about for expansion who are kind of getting maybe tired of going with these ups and with the ups and downs? Adam Silver. Yeah, so I'm tremendously empathetic to those fans. I will speak directly to Seattle and very much appreciate your being here. I wish I could be more conclusive today and say, here it is, here's the timeline. There are events that are clearly outside of my control. Part of it, as I said, is trying to assess value in a way that's both fair, even to a potential owner, and fair to the existing owners in terms of what it means to add additional partners, different cities, divide up our current media pie with a 31st or 32nd share, and also we want to make sure we put teams in a position, particularly as we're setting the price, to be in a position to be competitive, economically successful, and just as important for the other teams, successful on the floor. The issue I would not have anticipated at the time I sort of began talking about the timeline is how much unknown there is about local media right now. Having said that, though, I would just say again to our many fans in Seattle, and I hear from them often, and the legacy of the Sonics is still very strong and it's a fantastic basketball market, is that we are very focused on it. The fact, I think, that I'm not being more sort of forthcoming publicly doesn't mean we're not studying it very intensely. We don't take those fans for granted. We're thankful that the interest has remained over all these years. So I would just say the fact that we're not ready to make any public announcements with a specific timeline doesn't mean we don't care a lot about those fans and we aren't focused on the potential for the NBA to return to Seattle.
What does all this mean? It's a lot of words that are basically saying nothing. Like, I don't think they're
saying nothing. I think there are some important things in there.
Well, I guess to me, the local media piece is just like, there's always going to be something.
I think that is accurate.
And if that's the case, if the case is going to be, there's all, like, it's not going to change. By the time you've, like, first off, they're never going to figure out local TV deals. That's not going to be a thing that across 30 teams in the entire nation that they're going to have everything figured out and understand it completely.
I mean, they might have it figured out because there might not be local TV deals at some
point.
Or
that, but even then they might be like, well, we have to understand the subscription model and we have to see how this goes and that's going to take 2 years. Like, that's what I'm saying about there's always going to be a thing.
I agree.
There's always
that.
Going to be a reason to not do something.
I do think that, like, people in Seattle kind of took it as like, well, look, they said it was, you know, CBA, national TV deal, et cetera, and then expansion. And it's like, the NBA isn't required to hold to that. The NBA does not OU expansion. They're a business. They can do what they want. But I think the most critical part of this is when Adam Silver says there are things that are clearly outside of my control, I think that partially relates to the local TV deals, but I think it more relates to the fact that Adam Silver is not a dictator. He does not operate by fiat. He does not answer to the people of Seattle. He answers to the 30 team owners, the governors, and those are the people who have to vote for expansion. And they don't have the votes right now. That's what he's telling you with that statement.
And I think that's why he's bringing up all the other pieces, right? Where it's just like, oh, we have to figure this out. We have to figure that out. That might be something that those specific owners are saying. There's probably a pot of owners who are like, yes, no matter what, right?
Right.
And then there's
a pot of owners to whom the idea of the immediate influx of, you know, at this point, we're talking probably $12 billion in expansion fees, somewhere between $10 and $12 billion if there's two teams. And so that's a lot of money.
Does it have to be an equal share right away? And is that, I'm sure that's part of the conversation.
Yes.
Most of these motherfuckers won't even be owning the teams in possibly the time period that we're talking about, right?
Yes, although it still dilutes the value of your team when you go to resell it.
Yeah.
I guess the way I would put it. It's diluting the equity. I'm
a little bit skeptical about that. If we're being like, it's a constant upward arrow. The arrow doesn't go down.
It also doesn't seem to be based on any business thing. It's more based on how much prestige there is in owning an NBA team, which is part of the reason. So, you know, one of the things that Tim Booth highlighted in his story, and then I also listened to him on the Iconic Sonics podcast, is the fact that, you know, Silver sort of hints at the possibility that it might not be, you know, a two-team expansion. It might not necessarily be two teams at the same time. He took that to be a reference to Las Vegas's uncertain arena situation, where there's a variety of potential NBA arenas. I don't think that's it. An NBA team could easily play in T-Mobile Arena, especially if it was only a short-term scenario. I think that's more a question of, we have a pretty good idea that there are multiple parties interested in owning a team in Las Vegas, and that because of that competition, the NBA is going to get the kind of price that they want for an expansion team in Las Vegas. Because rich people want to own an expansion team in Las Vegas.
Do they
own an
not
NBA team in
Seattle,
Vegas.
Though?
Rich, I mean, I know. It's not the same kind of glamour market. It's LA, Vegas, Miami.
Who are these rich? I mean, isn't there kind of a rich person in Seattle that...
Are we talking about Jeff Bezos, or are we talking about the Kraken ownership group? I mean, is Jeff Bezos in Seattle? That's a question. I mean,
but they may not. You're saying they may not have an indication that he's actually interested.
I there's been no reporting to suggest that he is interested in owning an NBA expansion team, even though obviously he has broached purchasing the Washington Commanders. And like, if there's not a competitive market for it,
why didn't he buy the Washington Commanders then?
I don't know.
Just decided not to. Because the money probably, I mean, like, money is a factor, but like, he could have beaten the offer.
Yeah, I don't think it's that Jeff Bezos went to his checkbook and was like, can't do it.
Okay, fair enough.
He's like, stocks are down. I think that they're, you know.
What is the, do you feel like there's a dollar amount, or is that dollar amount ever changing? Because again, the arrow keeps pointing up.
I think the dollar amount is subject to negotiation, I guess is what I would put it. I mean, that's one of the things we don't know about the process is, will there be a fixed price? Will there be open bidding for these teams? Those are the questions we don't know. Like, there's not going to be another market that's going to bid more than Seattle. But I do think if you're ranking the two cities in terms of likelihood to get a team, Vegas is number one and Seattle is number two for that reason. Even though Seattle is clearly a better NBA market.
Fair enough. Have they brought up the conversation about only expanding to a single city?
Well, that's what divide up our current media pie with the 31st or 32nd share seems to imply. That's the first time we've heard anything like that from Adam Silver, I would say.
That's kind of what we're jumping on. Because I do think if you have a number, if there's a number set in Vegas, $10 billion or something, if somebody buys a team for $10 billion, I feel like they can find an owner in Seattle for that same amount.
I don't think so.
You don't think that they could find an owner for that same number here?
No.
You think the number will be higher in Vegas if they weren't matched to each other?
I think the number could be higher in Vegas, yes.
it doesn't really make sense to me because it's a worse market. And you think it's basically just because the rich people would rather own a team there.
If you don't live in a city, maybe you don't even live in the United States. What's the place you want to go to? What's the place you want to take a private jet to? Like, the answer is Las Vegas. That's why.
Okay.
So
I'm having a really hard time with this process of not just saying, do we even care? Like, at this point, like, that is, and I think they are really teetering on. I understand there are a lot of Sonics fans out there, but like, I don't think
the NBA
know.
Needs to be careful. I would agree with that on Seattle. But what I would say is,
if
Adam
they
Silver's...
expand to Vegas, it is, I think that they might have, it could be close to scorched earth for the NBA in Seattle. If they expand to Vegas and not Seattle at that point, like, even the language, I'm just like, whatever. Like the whole, like,
perhaps
rosy
so.
About Seattle, I'm just like, this does nothing. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, it is,
nobody's
still
like
nice to hear,
oh,
that
well,
messaging.
Adam Silver is empathetic.
There was a period of time where I've talked about this, I think, on the podcast, where, like, when the Seattle Storm ownership group, the independent ownership group, Force 10 Hoops, bought the Storm and kept them in Seattle, one of the things they had to do to accomplish that was to convince the NBA that Seattle was not this group of people that all hated pro sports and was so excited the Sonics left and would never spend a dollar on it.
Was this David Stern or is this Adam Silver?
This was David Stern.
Okay. I mean, I think Adam Silver, or David Stern, had that been the dialogue, is because he told the rest of the ownership that was the case here with the intent of moving the team to Oklahoma City.
I think so it was also a response to, and frankly, this was in the news lately. We are remembering the late Frank Chopp, who passed away recently. The way that Frank Chopp treated David Stern when he went to the Washington State Legislature to try to muster support for a, arena renovation at that point of Key Arena. I think that David Stern was a very proud man. I do not think he appreciated the way that he was treated by the Washington State Legislature.
I mean,
Frank Chopp in particular, Speaker of the House.
Do we generally think, though, as people who live in the state of Washington, Frank Chopp was right?
I mean, it was not a good business deal for the city of Seattle. I mean, it didn't really affect the Washington state as a whole.
Or the city of Seattle, right? I mean, Frank Chopp was representing Washington State.
Correct. Well, I guess his district was in Seattle.
Okay.
But the vote was by the entire state legislature. Whether the state legislature should actually have control over that degree of funding, I think, is a different, more technical bureaucratic question. Sometimes we prefer large oversight by the greater body, and sometimes we don't. Politically,
it's complicated.
It is very complicated. I mean, it also, like, it. Seattle's been without an NBA team for a long period of time. So just because we got a great deal ultimately with Climate Pledge Arena and it being privately funded, it came at a pretty huge cost, I would say. So
I think it would be a really tough pill to swallow. And like, I don't sit here and pine for a basketball team. You know what I mean? Like, as an individual who went to basically every single game for over a decade, I'm not like thinking about having a team here in that same way. And I'm sure that there are people who are, but to me,
perhaps even hosts of this podcast,
there are exciting parts
every single day.
Also just feels like a burden, you know, like,
I think this is a you problem.
It might be a me problem. I don't know, but I'm like, my life is fine right now. I'm good. And shit like this, I'm just like, if you don't want us, like, fine, go play your basketball somewhere else. Am I wrong about that? Like, if you're that concerned with the billions of dollars from owners in Vegas vis-a-vis Seattle, like, at some point you just have to be like, you know what, dog, you run your business that way. Cool.
I think that is a distinctly minority opinion. What I do think exists is, like, Sonics fans' frustration about the can getting, keep getting kicked down. And the
yes,
one thing I will say is
all of it, though.
The one thing I will say is, other than Adam Silver's comments at the beginning of the year, which I'm sure he regrets making, given what transpired afterwards.
Think he thought he had? And the thing is, I'm not blaming Adam Silver. I'm talking about the NBA in general.
Right. Okay. Other than that, a lot of the optimism about the timeline has not been coming from the league. And I would say that the tenor of local sourcing on the timeline for expansion and the likelihood of expansion has generally been more aggressive and more optimistic than what we've seen from national sources.
So you mentioned there was a conversation Bill Simmons and Zach Lowe today about expansion. Is that right?
I haven't listened to that yet.
Oh, okay. I thought you had listened to it.
No.
Well, then you have nothing to add.
I do on this particular point. I'm going to check it out now. No one had mentioned that part of the pod to me yet.
They hadn't. This is on the Discord, which, by the way, if you're not on the Discord, what are you doing?
Was it?
Yeah. I'm not saying to you. I'm talking about to general, the listener who's not on the Discord.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. There was one reference to it. I didn't realize it was a lot. Okay.
No, I don't know how much more there was than that. But like, even the fact that they were discussing, and I assume that there's, you know, I doubt it was just like a super random aside, but I'm sure that there's a further conversation about it. And I do trust that Simmons and Zach Lowe have some inside knowledge of what's going on within the league. But I'm
Bill
just
Simmons
saying,
has like, generally been very plugged in on this process.
And he's been positive about it. He has been, again, like you talk about the local media. Every time that I've heard him talk about it, it's basically like, this is happening.
I do think this is going to happen. I don't know what the timeline is.
But what, like, sure. You know, that's like, do I see the sun becoming a black hole at some point? Of course I do. You know, but I don't know the timeline for that.
It's also important to recognize the limits of knowledge. The future is unknowable.
The Pelton cast.
Is that a new slogan for us?
It's important to recognize the limits of knowledge. But I'm just like...
And to believe we say that before we get into our Mariners coverage.
Is it that wrong to think that a league that is so concerned with... Basically, we're talking about, like, minimum they could find $5 billion for Seattle. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Could they find $6 billion for Seattle? Or where do you think that number... Where's the ceiling?
I think $6 billion is plausible.
Okay, so if
$6 billion, I think, is the number that they would probably want in the wake of the Celtics selling for more than that without control of their arena.
If they're so concerned that they can go get $8 billion in Vegas or something like that, also you're talking about possibly.
But again, the question is not like, because it's not like they're going to pick another team over Seattle. The question is not Seattle versus Vegas here. The question is Seattle versus diluting the team.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, it's not that they're picking another team over Seattle, but you're wrong about that. It is that they're picking another team over Seattle, because you can dilute the dilution happens, and if it happens with one team, it's still diluted.
I agree,
but they're choosing
saying,
to dilute it with Vegas instead of Seattle, so they are picking Vegas over Seattle.
Because the dilution is the $8 billion. If it's more money, then it might be worth the dilution for it than it would be for another thing. I don't really understand this argument.
But that's what there are things that are greater than just the expansion fee. Like, they're still choosing to do the diluting in Vegas.
But
even if the
that
money
could
is
be
higher,
worth it because the money is higher. Seattle is not competing with Vegas again, because it's not an either or situation. Seattle is competing with, is it worth expanding by two teams?
You're saying Vegas is happening.
I'm saying in that scenario, I agree with Bill Simmons that Vegas is more likely, and that I wouldn't say that Vegas is necessarily happening. I think there is a question about expansion first, but once they make the expansion decision, Vegas is ahead because of that.
Okay. But I don't think it's a hard thing to understand that if you're a Seattle fan and you're seeing this as like, there's a person who's out there who's willing to spend $6 billion on a team in Seattle.
I don't know if there is. I'm saying that, it's plausible that there
that
is.
If there's a plausible
in a group, let's be clear.
Sure. To spend that kind of money for a team in Seattle and the league is like, we're good. We don't want to dilute our product with you. Just like the product. Like what are we talking about here? You know, I've watched a lot of NBA basketball this year, probably too much. And the product wasn't that impressive. So
the product is better than it ever has been.
Except for Tumani Kamara, baby. that is one product we could get behind.
Your sine wave of Blazers fandom never ceases to disappoint.
But Blazers and Lakers are teams. But there is kind of a reality of like, at some point, is it just is it just not that fun to pay attention. And I do think you probably hurt the viewership in Seattle overall. And I think you the interest in a team coming back,
if the team
think wanes.
If the team happens, you know, if the team happens within this process, I don't think what is going on right now will not be remembered.
No, no, I agree. But if it doesn't happen, is what I'm saying.
Yes,
if
I
a
agree
team
with
goes
that.
To Vegas, or if it keeps going
but, I mean,
for
the
another
counter,
10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was going to say the counter example to that is LA, but LA does not exactly embrace the Rams and the Chargers.
Yeah,
so
what are you talking about?
It's not a counter example. It is just an example.
I was there. They won the Super Bowl and no one cared. One guy. One person in the entire city cared.
If the Sonics win the NBA Finals, I guarantee people will care. I am very confident of that fact. All right.
Well, Seattle isn't a place where there's fans of other teams. Everybody's a fan of another team. Because
people
haven't
jumped
one.
On the Devonte Kamara bandwagon quite to that degree.
Once they see Kamara in HD, I'm watching him at standard definition right now. That's why I saw the deal. I'm sure maybe we'll talk about this later with the storm on Coons 1. And I'm like, is that HD? Or are we going to be watching standard definition storm games? Because I guess I'm used to it. Anyway.
I'm very confident that is.
I'm fascinated to see where this conversation goes. It does feel like I'm just honestly very sick of talking about it, though, because I'm sure you are, too. You know, like people are constantly asking you about it, I assume. Right. And it's kind of just like, well, eventually, we're getting nothing. We are getting nothing right now. And ultimately, what you're telling me is it kind of boils down to there aren't enough rich guys in the city to buy the team. Darn.
Yeah.
Maybe I don't even like sports. I only care about the Mariners somehow. What happened?
On that note, it's time for your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, it has been a week of baseball already, and hoo boy, has it been a doozy. This has been one of those weeks that makes you just want to hit the Bass Pro Shop, strip down, buck naked, and take a leap. And I'm sure the haters are just loving it out there right now, because everything they said all offseason has been correct. The team didn't spend enough. They can't hit. Blah, blah, blah. Still sick of that too. And that's true, but only partly. Because what if I told you those same people were saying that the Mariners were wasting an all-time great pitching rotation? But guess what, buddy? Joke's on you, because the starting pitching staff sucks too. Granted, they're 27th in runs scored per game, but they're also 18th in runs allowed per game. The starting rotation's win probability added is negative, and all of these games have been at home where the rotation has to be especially dominant. But if that isn't happening, all of your complaining about Alex Bregman or whatever just doesn't fucking matter. And I pored over this. I thought so hard about what they should do to improve things, because realistically speaking, same as with the rotation, if the catcher you just locked up for years has an OPS of 500 and your biggest free agent acquisition, I can't believe this is true, has you wondering if Mike Ford is still available, then maybe something is wrong. Because it is. We do this take every year. And its name is T-Mobile Park. Even in the best of times, T-Mobile Park is basically a big husk of metal, a kid's play area, and a bullpen for frat bros to get drunk in. But in the worst of, and even the average of times, it's cold as shit, the glimmers of sunlight are blinding, and most importantly, it doesn't give you the dingers. Which is why I'm saying three words. Not no holes. Rebuild the dome. The dome is what baseball was meant to be played in. You went there and you didn't know what time of day, year, or century it was. But what you did know is you got the dingers you deserved. These managers and batting coaches can't coach the current roster because they were hitting in a damn bad box with no regard for your marine layer. And they liked it. My family asked me to go to a game within these first couple of weeks. And what did I tell them? Hell no! I'm not trying to see 2.5 runs scored per game while I'm huddled up with a blanket. But if there were a dome, I have no interest in monarchy, but a kingdom in Seattle, we'd have no interest in the terrifying truth. but we'd get to see the team sock some dingers.
I like that you brought this all back to the Kingdom. Mike Ford signed a minor league contract with the Twins.
There we go.
After spending the second half of last season playing for Yokohama.
Not those Giants. All-time great.
Classic. I like that you did not adjust this take at all. For the Mariners, thrilling 3-2 win on Wednesday to close out their series against the Tigers. Where? Let's read the Meyer game-winning stat from today from Alex Meyer of Mariners PR. The Mariners became the first team to defeat a defending visiting Cy Young winner in the city he went to college since the Los Angeles Dodgers beat 1975 NL Cy Young winner Tom Seaver on August 18th, 1976, where he went to college at USC.
I will say I'm kind of shocked that it hasn't happened. Well, the same city, so the college has to be in the city.
Well, one of the possibilities.
Tim Lincecum.
Yeah, Tim Lincecum in UW.
It's just they didn't play that many games against. I don't feel like they faced Lincecum like almost never. But the fact that there have been a lot of good pitchers who went to UCLA at the very least. But then you kind of think about the big baseball schools, and they're not really in major cities
It is correct.
Baseball, so. And then a bunch of people skipped college. So I guess I'm not shocked, but I feel like it would have happened. Like Trevor Bauer would have been, he went to UCLA, right?
That sounds vaguely familiar.
That he wouldn't have been beaten in LA at some point.
Tim Lincecum did not pitch in Seattle in 2009, did not face the Mariners in 2009, and did not face the Mariners in 2010.
So there you go. I love the stat.
Still, it's a terrific stat. Love to see it.
All of this being said, I remain so hopeful for the Mariners. But I do think it's true.
The only time Bauer was the defending Cy Young winner, he pitched for the Dodgers.
Okay, fair enough.
So it was not actually plausible.
They have to be the current defending Cy Young winner, not just a former. I see.
Yes. Well, okay. I mean, the Dodgers remain the only major league team he has played for since winning the Cy Young in 2020.
I didn't realize that it had to be the following year, though, how specific this was.
Yes.
Wait, where did Verlander go to school? Or did he?
That's asking me a lot.
College baseball.
Tristan Verlander went to Old Dominion, which is does not at the current time. Norfolk, Virginia does not at the current time have a Major League Baseball team.
I was going to ask if I could try to guess where Old Dominion was, but...
Oh, I should have let you.
Norfolk, Virginia was not going to be the answer.
I knew Virginia. I could not have come up with Norfolk.
I thought it might have been in Philadelphia.
Often a safe bet. There's a lot of schools there.
Seems like a pretty Old Dominion.
Yeah. but not the oldest of the Dominions.
Slightly newer Dominion. Anyway, the take is true though of and there are good underlying stats like Rainier Rosarena. Some of the like base numbers haven't been that good, but he's hitting the ball hard. You know, I've been very happy with how Randy is hitting so far this year. But if Cal Raleigh is hitting the way that he's hitting and Julio Rodriguez is striking out as much as he's striking out, it doesn't matter who they've signed as free agents. You need the other guys to hit too. And so like just pinpointing it as, and I actually haven't heard this quite as much. It's more just like the fucking Mariners. I feel like that's the like most take.
I agree with that. Yes.
Which is not wrong. That is all true. But it's kind of like somebody has to do good for the additional people to matter. And you just know, I feel like...
Well, that somebody is the Mariners' best player. He's just been out of the lineup on paternity leave lately.
That is true. We knew that it was coming. I'm just waiting. I've Garv. I'm still holding on hope for Garver as well. I think it takes
currently
one
sitting
full
in the 237 ops.
One full year to adjust to T-Mobile Park. Like there is something wrong with the ballpark that they have not figured out.
It doesn't seem like they tried.
Should not. No, I'm not saying. But yeah, they should have built a dome over the offseason. But with the whiff rate, I don't know what the Mariners whiff rate is.
I mean, they really sold
right
themselves
now
on the small sample size of Edgar Martinez taking over as hitting coach and going the other way. The Mariners have not been striking out thus far as often as they did last season at home.
Really? But the yes. but the swings and misses have still been extraordinary.
I don't know where to access that data immediately.
The whiff data? Because I feel like that is still happening at an all-time level right now. It's kind of shocking how much that they are not striking out more than they were last year.
It's also worth noting that Wednesday's game, the first game I watched all season. In fact, I learned that they changed the score bug and all the graphics on the Root Sports broadcast today.
It was broken yesterday.
Oh, I had not seen one single second of Mariners baseball. And it's one of the rare games. The two games you have not watched, they have won. Am I correct here?
I watched most of today's game.
Oh, okay. It was just Sunday.
Yes.
All right, well, it's a long season. It's almost as long as the MLS season.
I mean, that's basically where I'm at right now. Like, the WRC Plus is not good for almost anybody, but Julio cannot be this bad for this long, I think.
I don't know why you're looking at Julio. Julio has been pretty good.
I mean, our standards for pretty good are
he's
quite
got a 380
low.
Ops.
He has a 32% strikeout percentage.
Okay, cool.
Strikeouts matter.
They matter to a degree. You know what matters a lot more? Actually getting on base and hitting the occasional dinger. I mean,
dinger solo.
I mean, are we going to have the Rowdy Tellez conversation?
Oh, I mean, he's gone. We don't have to have the Rowdy Tellez conversation. By the time this podcast comes out, he's not going to be on the roster. But that's what I'm saying about it. Kind of takes a year to adjust. I think Randy getting the timing of signing or of trading for Randy Arozarena was actually great for the Mariners because they got the second half of the season for him to adjust to T-Mobile Park. And I do think it takes a significant amount of time. Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that there's the health of Polanco and that he's played here now for a year. And I think it's a frustrating thing because Teoscar Hernandez probably would have been better had the Mariners wanted to re-sign him. It's funny seeing him in like the ESPN top 100 players, pretty high too. And it was just like an afterthought, right, for the Mariners. But
I think that was informed by his feelings about the Mariners. They could have certainly offered him a qualifying offer.
The two worst players on the team by WRC Plus are Donovan Solano, who does not have a hit all season, right?
I mean, it's 10 at-bats.
Still, but like he's not been on base.
That sample size is not going to create itself.
And Rowdy Tellez. I feel like Tellez hasn't even had competitive at-bats a lot of the time. You know, just the amount of the strikeouts and the groundouts, it's been rough. And I've watched all of them.
You know, to your point about not wanting the Sonics to be here because of how much work it is. Physician, heal thyself.
Oh my God, the offensive war. It is bleak.
Well, speaking of heal thyself, not exactly.
I don't know. I don't know why I care this much about the Mariners. I can't tell, but I just do. I'm sorry for that. I apologize.
Well, I've got some bad news for you because it turns out the Discord likes the Mariners. He cares about the Mariners even more than you do.
The dialogue, like, it's way more than a Seahawks game. You know, they only play 17 Seahawks games a year, no more. But they only play 17 Seahawks games a year. And I feel like people are kind of just like lukewarm or chatting about it. And it's like Mariners versus A's on a Saturday. And it's just like people are in it, right? Emerson Hancock is starting. People are dialed in. That so
well, Emerson
know.
Hancock had start Mariners now must decide how to handle that spot in the rotation Sunday in San Francisco after demoting him, replacing him on the roster with Jonathan Diaz, who could potentially start that. They could use off days to skip that spot and move up the rotation a day. I'll give that a we'll see.
That's a Jonathan Diaz to you, thank you. But I kind of wanted them to give Hancock another start. I don't love the like one game getting roughed up. And it wasn't that his stuff was terrible. The Tigers are just weirdly good at hitting the Mariners for some reason. And it was bad, but there were some balls that were kind of like, he got a little bit unlucky during the start. And his command, I think, like, let him work through this. And I think one more start at the beginning of the season, if it goes as badly, it doesn't cost you the season.
I think it's more just about let's keep Hancock on you know, a rotation and let him work into things. I don't think this is the end of him in Seattle.
I'm not saying it's the end of him in Seattle, but like, and he will get another start again. This is crushing to your confidence. If he's in the rotation, right? Kirby gets hurt.
You know who like I feel Emerson. Like knows more about Emerson Hancock's confidence than I do?
Who's that?
The Seattle Mariners?
Sure. I guess that's one of those things where you could just be like, well, we have to trust the team because they did it. There
we
are
don't
many
have to
times
trust the team on whether Emerson Hancock is good because there's information available on that. But his mental state,
sure,
yeah, that one I'm going to go ahead and give the benefit of the doubt to the Mariners because I don't know shit about it.
I'm
again. What did we say earlier? Recognize what you don't know.
No, I think there's like limitations to knowledge. Like yeah, okay, there are limitations to knowledge. I wanted them to give Emerson Hancock one more start. I felt like it would have been good for him to have, you know, worked out some demons there and gotten through an inning.
And
even in the game,
there may not be a start to have. Again, they might decide to move everybody.
There could always be a start to have. But the thing about like Dan Wilson and the Mariners, I was telling this to Luca, and I was like, it's so funny because Dan Wilson can know so much more than me about baseball, and also at the same time know less than me about baseball.
Yeah,
that's one of the crazy things about, I feel like, baseball in particular, more than almost any other sport, where it's just like, yeah, he's just doing a thing wrong. Like, that is, his process is wrong here. And it really comes from like certain limitations about how people approach the game in football and in basketball. Like, there's not a moment where I'm like, yeah, JJ Redick just doesn't know about basketball. Like, I just feel like I know the situation better than JJ does. But in baseball,
well,
there are
moments. Third Felton brother JJ would never.
I know I should compare Dan Wilson to JJ, the best coach, but like, that's not fair. But I'm not comparing Gabe Kaplan. Is that the coach we like? Do we like him?
Gabe Kaplan is an actor. Maybe thinking of Gabe Kapler.
May he rest in peace.
is Gabe Kaplan dead? Oh dear, I kind of hope. I guess I hope that so. No,
Gabe
very
Kaplan.
Much alive. Very much alive. Hey, Janie, Gabe Kaplan.
Really makes you think, doesn't it? Welcome back. Do we like Gabe Kapler?
Gabe Kapler is a very JJ Redick-like manager. I will concede the point.
But like, I'm not comparing Dan Wilson to him. But I'm just saying there are moments like when he didn't pitch hit, you didn't know that this happened because you're not watching the games. There was a moment where it's like they obviously should be pitch hitting for Rowdy Tellez in this situation, and they just
Gabe Kapler is now the assistant GM of the Marlins. Huh. Okay, fair enough.
Really, Gabe? Yeah. Gabe Kaplan post at 80 years old.
Did I say Gabe Kaplan?
I think he was a Kaplan.
I hope I did.
If he was going to be the assistant GM of any team at 80, it does make sense. Anyway, it's been a week.
Only been a week.
And they face back-to-back Cy Young winners. Although one of them is Robbie Ray, so I'm kind of like, is he?
But also, 1-0 this season against Cy Young winners. So bring it on.
Also, what college did Robbie Ray go to?
I'm betting against a college there.
That sounded like very offensive. Where it's like Robbie Ray seems like he wouldn't go to college. Just like, fair enough. You are right, of course.
It is what it is there.
He decommitted from Vanderbilt. And then committed to Arkansas, and then was drafted.
A couple of injury updates via the Seattle Times. By the way, neither of those are major league cities.
If they had a team in Nashville, all of a sudden, this would be much more likely.
It is very true. Matt Brash is headed to a rehab stint in Tacoma after being with the Mariners in San Francisco this weekend. He's on track to return in late April. George Kirby continuing to make progress as he ramps up from shoulder soreness, scheduled to throw a side session in Arizona next in that process. Anything else on the Mariners? It's a long season. Seattle Kraken, as we get into the roundup, had lost five of their previous six entering Wednesday at Vancouver. when they get a 5-0 win over the Canucks. You'll recall a couple of years ago when the Kraken made the playoffs and they just could not beat Vancouver for a long period of time. And now it's the opposite. They can only beat Vancouver, it
there
seems
we go.
Like. They entered the night 4th in the lottery standings. So now I need to check how that has updated, because there were a number of teams right behind them in that regard with a handful more points. Yes, they have now fallen behind the Boston Bruins, although the Bruins do have one additional game to play, tied with the Buffalo Sabres, who have two additional games to play. There's 6 left in the regular season for the Kraken, who are one of 4 teams thus far eliminated from NHL playoff contention. Seattle Sounders, a pair of draws, 0-0 a week ago Saturday against the Houston Dynamo, 1-1 last Saturday at San Jose Earthquakes. In the Houston game, basically completely dominated defensively, just one shot on goal for Houston in 0.3 XG. The Sounders had 1.2 XG on their 4 shots on goal. Last Saturday, it was Hello Ungol, our old friend, is... The Sounders went behind 1-0 in the first half. Then Albert Rushnak saved the point by scoring in the 80th minute as the Sounders took a whopping 26 shots and put 10 on goal, posting 2.3 XG to 1.2 for San Jose. This weekend, the start of what I guess could be another rivalry, their first visit to Snapdragon Stadium to take on San Diego FC. The expansion club has started out well with 11 points from their first 6 matches and a strong +4 goal differential. There's been a Nordic flair to their attack. Danish designated player Anders Dreyer leads the team with 3 goals, while Finnish midfielder Oni Valakari has 2 goals and a team-high 3 assists. And a little bit of transaction news for the Sounders. Some transact. They signed former Liverpool winger Ryan Kent, who will practice at the team's facility in Renton, which is confusing. Kent last played in July after mutually agreeing with Fenerbahce to part ways in October after a falling out with their coach, one Jose Mourinho.
Hello.
The native of England played 5 seasons for Rangers, peaking with 10 goals and 9 assists at age 23 as the team won the Premiership in 2020-21. So,
okay, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. How many miles do you consider a city to be? Within 100 miles? Or so like
you're saying,
how far? Shane Bieber went to college, UC Santa Barbara.
No, it's not in the city of LA.
Cy Young. I'm just saying we're getting pretty close here.
I concede it.
2021 lost, not at the Dodgers, at the LA Angels in 2022 on April 25th.
Certainly Anaheim Stadium is much closer to it's not. Santa Barbara's the opposite direction, right?
I thought you were going to say that Seattle U.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, it's closer than it is not closer than Seattle U is to T-Mobile. That has got to be pretty close, like the closest ballpark you could get to a Division I to a Major League ballpark. That's got to be way up there.
Yeah.
That's a question for another day.
It's close. I mean, like, USC has to be pretty close to Dodger Stadium.
But Dodger Stadium is like way outside. I guess not way outside. That's
what
true.
You're talking about.
Yeah.
They're 5.6 miles away, USC to Dodger Stadium.
But like, I guess I don't know technically where it's. Yeah. Do they play at Champions Field? Is that
they have a stadium in Capitol Hill.
Championship Field. Assuming that is where it is, where they actually play baseball.
2 miles. Oh, that's close.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm telling you. It's walkable.
Hello.
Under 2 if you're walking it. 45-minute walk.
Oh, brisk. Brisk.
Easy doubleheader.
A 45-minute walk?
What are you seeing?
35 minutes.
Well, that's interesting.
I just put from Seattle U. I didn't put from the ballpark, I guess. I could do
it in
10.
They should not be. The idea that you're an exceptionally fast walker. You're not even the fastest walker on this podcast, sir.
I could run a mile and a half in less than 15 minutes.
Only one of us was named Speedwalker.
Are you named Speedwalker?
Yeah.
When?
Was it kid?
All right.
You don't think we made jokes about that?
I don't know if that's something I'd be proud of.
I agree. It would not be something I'm not proud. I didn't say I was proud of it. I
You
just
did
said.
save. You did save the kingdom.
Oh, bring it full circle. All right, Seattle Reign FC. Got a 2-1 win the previous Saturday at North Carolina Courage when they took a 2-0 lead through Jess Fishlock in the first half. An amazing goal by defender Jordan Bug in the 56th minute, the first of her NWSL career at age 18 from nearly 33 yards out, and then held on for full points at North Carolina, then suffered their first loss of the season last Sunday at Angel City FC. Jisoo Yoon converted a penalty in the 12th minute to answer in an early goal by Alyssa Thompson, but Angel City got the winner at home in the 63rd as the Reign took their first loss of the season heading into an international break this weekend. All right, Seattle Storm news. WNBA draft is coming up April 14th, and one player will not
soon.
Be.
Oh, my God.
That is, one player who will not be in the draft, Notre Dame guard Olivia Miles, considered the most likely number two overall pick most of the year, will, instead of declaring for the WNBA draft, she did not by Monday's deadline, instead submitting a notification of transfer is broken Monday night by my ESPN colleague, Shams Charania.
So what does this mean for the Storm? Do you think the Storm, we're assuming Paige Bueckers is number one?
Yes.
And have you heard any chatter about a trade, anything like that?
No, I mean, the thing is, like, if Dallas were going to decide to trade the pick, it would only because if Paige Bueckers told them she didn't want to play there. And yes. Her leverage was the potential to go back to UConn for a sixth season, since she has both the COVID season and a red shirt due to injury from her ACL tear. She has now made it very clear, abundantly clear, that she is declaring for the draft. So I think that all signs point to Paige Bueckers being taken number one by Dallas.
I'm just going to give a pretty large I told you so to you and to everybody else. There's so much chatter around it. It was like the storm were within like eyesight of Paige Bueckers, and people just made it a story. And I was like, there's just not, it is fanciful to have imagined this. I thought you had inside fanciful. Knowledge. People were talking it so much. I thought you had inside knowledge that it was happening. Unless you,
what percentage chances did I give it when we talked about it?
100%.
I would like to review. Yeah, I definitely
you
give it up.
You seemed way more confident about it. Your normal disposition would be much more negative than it was.
I think what I said at the time was that any chance of getting Paige Bueckers was worth getting excited about.
But there wasn't any chance of getting Paige Bueckers.
I think at the time there was a chance of getting Paige Bueckers.
Okay. Anyway, assuming Paige Bueckers is number one, knowing who is likely to declare for the WNBA draft, who is the most likely selection now for the Storm with Olivia Miles? Do you think it would have been Olivia Miles?
I think the most likely scenario here, just completely speculating with no actual knowledge on this,
that's
likely scenario.
What I love.
Exactly. That's what we encourage on this podcast. The most
there
likely
are things
scenario
that are unknown. There are limits to knowledge.
There are limits to our knowledge. The most likely scenario is that Olivia Miles did not think the Storm were going to take her number two. And that is why she decided not to declare for the draft.
Because she would have wanted to play for the Storm, or she wanted to be a top two pick?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, the alternative, both the 3 and 4 picks are held by Washington, who is beginning what looks like it will probably be an extended rebuild. So I don't think that's as exciting as going to play for, you know, a team that at the very least will be competitive next season with Neko Ogwumike, with Skylar Diggins-Smith.
And it was both of those picks, 3 and 4, that the Mystics have. So it would have been almost a lock that she was drafted there if the Storm passed, or it wasn't like 100% for the Storm. Let me ask you, is there, outside of the Paige Bueckers of the world, Angel Reese, players like that, and Caitlin Clark, obviously, is there much NIL money in women's college basketball right now?
Yes. I mean, it's not at the level of those players who have national deals. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's not a reason not to go pro, the existence of NIL, but it is a reason not to feel compelled to go pro.
I mean,
are able to make a decent amount in college.
I feel like there's this conversation in the NFL, right? Like Carson Beck will make more money this next season, almost certainly, than players who are drafted, quarterbacks who are drafted, right? He'll make that at Miami and then be drafted. Like there are times, I still think most players prefer to be in the NFL, and your maximum capacity money is higher in the NFL than it is in college. But with how low that WNBA needs to hurry as far as paying players.
I mean, it's going
to
happen. But it's going to be next year.
With that new deal, is it done? Is that deal negotiated?
It's not done, but there is no scenario where there is not a massive pay increase for WNBA players. The other piece of this is then the money you can make playing during the off season, whether it's now for Unrivaled or going overseas.
You can't do that if you're in college. Is there any reason that college players couldn't go play for, or you can't be pro at all?
You can't be pro at all, but also they happen at the same time. So okay, that's the reason. The Unrivaled season overlaps notably. So that was like a talking point for a while. Howard Megdahl of The Next argued that Paige Beckers could go through the draft and then still have the leverage of, well, I'm just not going to play in the WNBA this season. I'll strictly play Unrivaled. I do not find that a likely scenario.
Just Dallas is, I understand that the franchise, like people, it's one of, I feel bad for the fucking Dallas Wings that people are just like, Paige Beckers will do anything to get away from there. And I'm like, it doesn't happen that often. She's not Eli Manning.
Or John Elway. As a reminder, It's not only Eli Manning. It is also John Elway.
That's fine. But all of these things happened 20 plus years ago.
I mean, the John Elway thing happened 40 plus years ago. It was the 1983 draft, I'm pretty certain. But
okay, so without Olivia Miles, who is the most likely pick at number two then?
So what I would tell you is what I've put on Blue Sky in the immediate wake of this is talking to people in the WNBA. And this was reinforced by Ben Pickman and Sabrina Merchant of The Athletic did a piece last week anonymously talking to various league executives and scouts about prospects. And people rave about Dominique Malonga.
Okay.
Like, people don't talk about her. Fans generally don't talk about her here because she's playing in France and she's not in the Final Four. She's not in the Sweet 16 like Olivia Miles was. But people in the league are very high on her potential. In fact, one person with another team, not with the Storm, texted me after this news and said, this clears the way for the Storm to take the best player in the draft at number two.
Hello.
So I can't get there. Paige Beckers is amazing. I saw her score 74 points in two games in Spokane. Complete control of the moment. I think she's far and away the best prospect. I think she is very likely to be a star in the WNBA. But
can you spell Dominique Malonga for me?
It's Dominique like Dominique Wilkins.
Yep.
Malonga is Malonga.
I thought it was a B instead of an M. Okay. Hmm.
So we've talked about this. She's having a terrific season in the Euro Cup, the second highest, cross-continental league in Europe. 6'6", 19 years old, tremendous potential. Doesn't really feel a need for the Storm because, I think down the road, you could potentially play her and Ezzie Magbegor together if she is the pick at number two. It is a rookie. You've got Neko Gumake at power forward. She's probably going to play a relatively limited role, smaller than Olivia Miles would have played had the Storm drafted her number two.
But if the talent and the potential is there, who cares?
The other thing about this is if players sit out the 2025 draft who the Storm weren't going to take at number two, know who that's good news for? Year. The Seattle Storm, who have three first-round picks in the 2026 draft. So the other player worth watching on that count is Flauje Johnson from LSU. I was in there in the locker room after LSU was eliminated on Sunday in the Elite Eight. She said, I don't know about her future. She can declare for the draft is a junior because she turns 22 this year. She already, like Paige Beckers, has a deal with Unrivaled. It still seems like the sense is probably she's not getting out of the draft. She might be a consideration for the Storm at number two if she did, because she really, if you're comping her to a WNBA player, I think Jewel Lloyd has many similar skills to Jewel Lloyd, like fits kind of perfectly the need in the current Storm starting lineup. And does have a lot of long-term potential as well, maybe even more than Olivia Miles. But probably, again, not the worst scenario for the Storm if she goes back and is part of the 2026 draft that would at that point be pretty loaded.
It's Dominique Malonga. They're taking it, right?
If I were doing a mock draft, I would have Dominique Malonga in that spot.
I'm kind of excited about this. I mean, I get it. Paige Beckers would be an instant star, but
Well, the other thing about the one concern about Dominique Malanga is that with the French national team, her availability on a season by season basis is going to be uncertain.
So you got to pay the players. Like the, all
but,
of
but
these
even
things.
If you pay the players, the FIBA still has to change their calendar for it to ultimately matter. Like the national team is going to be more important to these players.
The WNBA bet a couple of years ago that all of these other leagues would change their calendars for the WNBA.
Well, you know what league didn't?
Who? France?
France.
France. I'm just saying.
Do you think France is going to be cowed by the WNBA?
I get it. But they will. There's a reality that the gravity of the WNBA, the second that Caitlin Clark was drafted, all of the other things didn't matter. Like, the entire league changed in that moment. FIBA's going to change. France is going to change. It's not because it's like a France versus the USA thing. It's the WNBA is the most important women's basketball league in the world. And the players are the ones who are going to push it.
It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Also, the Storm have probably some unique inside info on Malanga because one of her teammates on the French national team is Gabby Williams. So,
anyway, I'm kind of hyped on this. I feel like a high upside. Like, we could be looking back at this type of moment where it's like, oh, she's better than Paige Bueckers.
That is, again, a possibility.
This is fun.
I don't think it's a likelihood, but it's a possibility. Also, they haven't taken her. And the draft is not for another 12 days.
If they take her. This is fun. Who are the best?
But Paige Bueckers is known to be in the draft, and Malanga is automatically eligible. So this was what I was saying kind of all along, is that you know that there are going to be two very good players.
Who's the best foreign WNBA player of all time?
Who's the best foreign WNBA player of all time? I mean, I guess Jonquel Jones, but, you know, she's not. Is it? Am I missing someone obvious here? Emma Mieseman is probably the greatest European player, which is a slightly different question.
And Jonquel Jones went to college.
Oh, Penny, well, actually, yes. This is a dumb.
Lauren LJ.
It's Lauren Jackson. Yes, I'm thinking of European players in my head here. Obviously, it's Lauren Jackson. Yeah. Still? Penny Taylor also very high on the list. So, okay,
could be interesting.
Yeah. You alluded to this earlier. The Storm announced earlier this week that their games will air locally on both Como and KUNS. All the games, all 33 games that are going to be locally televised, will be on KUNS, which, yes, have confirmed, is in HD.
Wow!
Channel 1051
next
on your Comcast
year,
package.
Look at the Blazers. You know, they're within three games of the playoffs. I feel like they might have earned it. They might have earned some high definition for next year.
They have definitely earned high definition. Like, if we were doing it for the rundown, the Blazers are doing it for HD.
There we go. Do it for HD, Blazers.
13.
Most fun team in the league. Most fun team in the league. There's nobody else who's as interesting as Blazers.
I don't know if I go that far, but 13 of their 33 games are also airing on Como, so those will be, you know, very easy to find on a prominent channel. That's
who is more fun to watch than the Blazers? And, like, yes, like the big teams, I get it, but
I mean, I think if we're talking about young team, I mean, I don't know. I really enjoy watching Houston.
Okay,
Amen Thompson, yeah. Etc.
They would be like top five, like league pass rankings.
You know the conversation we need to have. Scoot's having a much better second year. Feel good about his future. If the Blazers had taken Amen Thompson, number three,
is he way better?
Oh, Amen Thompson's one of the 10 most valuable trade prospects in the league, God. In my opinion.
Where's Kamara though? Like number two.
I mean, Damani Kamara has an outstanding contract.
He's awesome.
Has become a very good player. Denny Avdija also has a pretty
Denny.
Amazing contract.
They're just a fun team.
He's the Blazers' best player, in my opinion.
I still think
with
Scoot's
all due
gonna
respect
develop.
To Kamara. I'm not down on Scoot, but I am high on Amen Thompson. Is what I would tell you here.
You're saying that like it's like an indie take. Everybody is, right?
Everybody's high on Amen Thompson. Some people are higher on him than others. You know, women's basketball, it feels like forever ago.
I don't even have to talk about this game.
They played an NCAA tournament game against Columbia in the first four. They led by 13 at halftime, then were outscored 42-26 in the second half, committing the majority of their 15 turnovers. CBS Sellers led a late push, but missed a shot that would have tied the game with 26 seconds remaining. Ella Dean then also missed a potential tying three down the stretch. But Ladin, Sellers, and Delia Daniels combined for 54 points. Hannah Steins had five. The other four players who saw action combined for just one shot attempt and 1 point. So ultimately, you know, that lack of depth, and I was disappointed by this one. This was a game that was very winnable. Felt like the Huskies were not as prepared as they should have been for Columbia's press, and committed some turnovers that were really costly in the second half of this one. But still an outstanding accomplishment for them to get back to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2017. And they did it with only one senior starter in Delia Daniels, who will very much be missed, is the post anchor of this team. Transfers Tyra Eke, who did not play in that game at all, was kind of interesting. And then Brennan McDonald are also out of eligibility. But the Huskies had a recruiting class rated number 12 overall by ESPN Hoop Girls, including three top 100 players, led by 6'2" forward Bryn McGahey from Spokane, who may have the ability to step into Daniel's role in the post.
It wouldn't have mattered because there just are not upsets in women's college basketball in the women's NCAA tournament or the NCAA tournament. There just aren't upsets at all. You just pick the higher seed, you're good. They would have been throttled in the next game, this team, but I thought it was an embarrassing performance.
I mean, they also were. I mean, I don't believe in embarrassing performances generally.
The way that they were unable to react to the pressure from Columbia was the piece that was embarrassing. Was like, it should not be this hard to when you've been through a Big Ten schedule, a little bit of pressure defense should not have fazed them as much as it did, and they were unable to react to it at any point.
I think it's plausible that part of it was also that this was the first time in that scenario and that there were some nerves at play. Again, there are limits to our knowledge of how much of a factor that was. None of it boded well for the ability to go up against West Virginia, as we talked about, in their turnover-forcing prowess in the round of 64 had they gotten there. But I'm not going to ultimately lose too much sleep over this one. Again, it was an outstanding season. And, you know, you wish... You just want to take a little bit of a step forward next year and be out of the first four and in a situation where you're in the NCAA tournament for real.
Do you think that's enough?
I think that's plausible.
I mean, the response was like they're in like freaking 40 minutes of hell for that game. But do you think that's enough?
It was like 10 minutes of hell. Yeah,
a solid 20. And the frustrating thing is
it wasn't the entire second half.
You watch women's NCAA tournament games and then you watch men's NCAA tournament games and you're like, just make these the rules. The advancing the ball. Just like, it's so simple.
The quarters? They're so much better.
I don't know if I really feel strongly about it, but it is kind of like, why?
When you get in the bonus, you don't stay in the bonus for like 8 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the reason the quarters matter.
Why are the rules different?
That's a great question. They experimented with it. I watched an NIT game with quarters. Chandler Hutchison and Boise State were here against UW.
They were like, whoa. We experimented with this, but those quarters screwed everything up.
You know, like a lot of people experimented with things in college. UW men's basketball will return to the Acrisure Invitational to defend their title next November. Granted,
finally, some good news for UW. We own you, Acrisure Invitational.
There's not going to be a lot of returning Acrisure Invitational champs on the roster. What we know so far is that Vazumana Diallo and Frank Kepnong have signed NIL deals to return next year. Danny Sprinkle told Sports Radio KJR that last week.
How old is Frank Kepnong?
Probably not quite as old as you think he is.
Okay.
He has at least 1 year of eligibility remaining, and plausibly two. It is not inconceivable.
He can go to the Mariners, and they have 24 hours to determine whether he has two or not.
He is 23. He will be 24 by opening night.
It's still pretty old.
It's not young. We were doing this.
Your Alden Thompson's probably like 19 or something.
No, he's not as young as you. He's not as Frank Kepnong might not be quite as old as you think he is. Amon Thompson's older than you think he is. He's 22.
Really? Oh, really? Wait.
Yeah, I mean he was 20 at the time he was drafted.
What did he do?
He was 20.
He walked the earth.
Coming from overtime elite.
Okay.
So it sounds like they might be the only returners. We saw three players submit notifications of reportedly submit notifications of transfer on Monday. The three most important remaining players on the roster: forward Tyler Harris, the second leading scorer and third leading rebounder; guard Mekhi Mason, who led the team with 53 three-pointers at a 40% clip and averaged 10.6 points per game in conference play; and center Wilhelm Breidenbach, who will apparently apply for a redshirt year after being limited to 10 games as a freshman at Nebraska. They joined, among others, who Jace Butler was the only one I think we talked about previously, Cote d'Ivoire native Dominic Diamand, who joined the Huskies midseason as a walk-on after playing professionally in France but redshirted, and he already, it has been reported, will transfer to BYU. Christian King, who averaged 2.5 points per game as a red freshman, shooting 38.5% on threes but having a tough time staying on the floor, and Casey Ebekwe, who saw just 68 total minutes of action, is a backup center despite Kepnong's injuries. Do you have any thoughts on those?
And I actually think bringing Kepnong and Vazumana back, like they obviously prioritized who they cared about coming back, right? It was Zoom. They cared about Zoom. They cared about Frank. Frank Kepnong is a 24-year-old, might be dominant if he could be healthy in college basketball. It's just the average age of college basketball teams has to be getting older, right?
Yes, although this was the last of these scheduled fifth COVID years. Those are now coming to a conclusion, but still the more liberal eligibility rule is the JC ruling, etc. Yes.
Things with youth and college sports are about to get real weird over these next couple of years. There's literally talk about Tahoma High School as like a 21-year-old baseball player transferring there. And it's just like, again, like the amount of players who are going to be going, if it is true that they don't count as college eligibility years, we'll see what happens. But the amount of players who are going to go to JCs before they start their college career, it's just going to be massive, right?
I mean, I suppose there's only so many spots at the community college or junior college level at the end of the day.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's going to be like people are going to be desperate to find the best JCs.
But it does make those players relatively more valuable to bring in than they once were.
And again, that overall age is just going to get so much older. So I'm a little surprised that Tyler Harris wasn't somebody. I mean, we have no idea what the budgets are for this. You know, it's
the fact that their decisions came when they did, I think, suggests that they were certainly considering a return. And what changed on Monday is impossible to say. We'll see whether that's because of the fact that the Huskies were prioritizing players that they have targeted as recruits from other teams.
I would guess that that's probably the case. It's money. Like, the thing that happened was money. We know what it was.
Right.
It's not like,
but why, whether that
Sprinkle
was,
had a he really rubbed them the wrong way.
Well, no, it's more like, is it because someone else offered them a huge bag or because UW made the decision to move on?
UW offered somebody else whatever that bag is. So yeah. I bet it's a combination of both.
Right.
You know, and I doubt the numbers are huge for Tyler Harris and Mekhi Mason because maybe it's that somebody else just valued those players more than UW is. You know, one of the things where, like, if you're not in the program, sometimes having too much information is bad.
Well, I mean, I think I would also think about it this way. Like, economists would say basically everyone should transfer every year. Because what are the odds you were at the single school out of 350 in the country that values you the most? The odds are extraordinarily low.
Yeah.
You were at the single best school for you.
What
so
else?
If there is no longer almost any friction to transferring, almost everyone should transfer every year.
Is there a notification of transfer? Is that the same as entering the transfer portal, or does that mean they are going to transfer?
That is the same as entering the transfer portal. It's the technical term for it, because as you know, I do not like the way that we talk about the transfer portal.
Did you get lost in there sometime? Who hurt you in the transfer portal?
The NCAA media. Because, especially because, as I have talked about before, I hate to reiterate, when people refer to the transfer portal era, what they actually mean is the transfer liberalization era, where the rules about transferring change. The portal is literally just a database of contact information.
Words matter, people.
I recognize
I love that,
that
this
there
is your
to
hill to die on. Oh. For me, it's building a dome. For you, it is a semantic issue around the naming of the transfer portal.
And the description of it.
And the description of it, sure. But the thing is, I agree with that. Like, that makes sense.
So some of these players could also return, yes, to your point.
So the NIL deals that they signed, it's a contract.
Yes.
They signed a contract, and it's basically just every single college athlete they're now on 1-year contracts.
Correct.
And those contracts are now called NIL deals.
Not every single one, but certainly the vast majority of them.
But I'm fascinated to see. These can be multi-year NIL deals, right?
I don't know that there's any reason they can't be, although because of the fact that things are still evolving so rapidly, I don't think either side probably wants to lock themselves into a multi-year deal at this time.
Michigan deal was a 3-year. It was basically the duration of his time at Michigan.
Who is this?
Quarterback.
I legitimately didn't hear you on that one.
Bryce Underwood.
Okay.
You still don't know who he is.
I heard Brad. No, I don't. I heard Brad Underwood, who's the men's basketball coach at Illinois. Four-year deal reportedly worth $10 million.
Four-year deal?
Yeah.
but also, there's I'm sure that there's various outs in there or whatever.
Certainly.
So it does seem like, and he's somebody who, if you're Michigan, you're like, we can, I don't know how binding of a contract these are, NIL deals or whatever. But that's basically like, it's just a different word for a contract.
Yes, without question.
And so the Huskies prioritized first Frank Kepnong, Zoom Diallo.
But that's where I'd say, like, just because those got done doesn't necessarily mean those were the biggest deals they offered or the first deals they offered. You know, that's just how the market played out.
I do think Diallo
was their priority. I have a hard time believing that they were like, we need to keep Frank Kepnong more than we need to keep Tyler Harris and Mekhi Mason.
Frank Kepnong has an agent, and they were like, here's the number. This is the number. And the Huskies were like, yes, or whatever.
Right.
They negotiated. They found the number. It made sense. Mekhi Mason and Tyler Harris. Do all these players have agents now?
I think so.
Are they legit proper agents that you would carry through hypothetically to your professional career? Or are they specific NIL agents?
That is a question beyond the limits of my knowledge at the present time. Some of them, I think, are.
I would hope that they are proper agents that players are signing with, that are having these conversations.
But I will say that there are probably different specialties, because your agent in professional sports, endorsements is a part of what they're doing, but it's a relatively small part. I mean, I guess the contract is with the team.
Can I tell you about endorsements? It's just fucking money from the team.
And yes. I mean, now that you're signing the NIL deals with the team, I suppose so.
It's not.
There are salary caps now in GM. So, yes.
But I also think the university is basically like, they're filling that same role that some franchises have of going out and getting those brand deals for the players as well.
Right.
Like, there are additional things on top of it, but the agents are basically negotiating salaries for the coming year.
Well, we can continue to discuss this over time.
Okay.
We should probably move ahead.
Okay. Who's coming in?
Well, they have added a transfer, Rutgers center Lathan Somerville, who started 15 games as a true freshman, all of them in conference play. He was the third leading scorer and rebounder for the Scarlet Knights, behind future NBA top 5 picks Dylan Harper and Ace Bailey. Shot just 53% on twos, but scored efficiently thanks to 86% foul shooting. That was pretty impressive for a big man. Say a below average defensive rebounder and shot blocker for a big. Somerville was originally a 4-star recruit from Peoria, Illinois, and held Zoom meetings with Butler and Villanova while flying out to Seattle to meet with the Huskies before making that commitment, per Jeff Goodman.
Cool.
We'll just note in the other teams.
I'll forget his name until October.
You undoubtedly will.
So the Huskies, basically, there are hundreds of players who are in the, what do you call it? Who have submitted their notification of transfer?
Correct.
I'm sorry, I didn't, God forbid I use the P word.
I mean, there are thousands of players who have submitted notifications of transfer.
And so the Huskies have a pot of money and they have to go find a roster.
Yeah.
All right.
So we'll stay tuned. You know what it means is so much more transact. All of the transact.
It's funny because this is somehow not fun transact.
Like, I think that's because of the fact that it's not going great for your job.
Maybe. We don't know.
Yeah,
they're gonna pick up good players.
Like, they do have a lot of money to spend without Kreidasabor on the payroll.
Players that we're excited about, or at least semi-hopeful about, the Huskies will sign those players. It's more just like having the roster change almost completely every year is not that fun.
I agree.
And that's where it's kind of like the multi-year deals will, like, once we get there, it will be more fun. Like, I'm more excited. Like, Zoom coming back is fun.
Correct. If it was a player who was equally good as Zoom Diallo and was not from Seattle and was not on the roster last year, it would not be as fun.
Yes.
100%.
Even though I hated watching Zoom Diallo. Mini plays.
Speaking
but I'm
of
sure he'll improve.
Turning over the entire roster, let's talk about UW softball. 2 weeks ago, they swept the doubleheader against Rutgers on Saturday by a combined 21-0 score, both in five innings. Stevie Hansen had a win-hit shutout in the first game,
Rutgers!
Into the fifth. Yeah,
lifelong rivals.
And we got Lathan Summerville from you.
Yeah.
Stevie Hansen had a one-hit shutout in the opening game, taking a no-hitter into the fifth, and Morgan Reimer and Sofia Ramuno combined on the shutout in the second game, with Alicia Flores recording five hits and five RBI over the two games. Huskies then beat Cal Poly 5-1 at home and won 3-2 in extra innings at Eastern Illinois before what was supposed to be a weekend series against Illinois in Champaign. They played only one game on Friday, beating the Illini 17-5 before Saturday's series finale was rained out. Alexis DeBoer in that one game went 4-for-5 with 2 home runs and 6 RBI, and Ava Carroll came within a triple of the cycle. Will Alexis DeBoer be the Seattle Sports Figure of the Year?
Oh, yeah. No, I love that. We won. We won the trade.
Worth noting Illinois, not a trade. Worth noting Illinois and Rutgers are combined 2-11.
You just couldn't let that be.
God, for, I mean, we could have had both. It wasn't. If you want to say they won the Kevin DeBoer Jed Fish trade, that's a different story. I know your feelings there.
I mean, after 1 year, let me just throw this out there. 2026 head coach of Alabama, Jed Fish.
I don't think they're going to go to the same well. I don't feel like Alabama
head coach of
UW are going to go that.
Kalen DeBoer.
Okay. Huskies were also rained out Tuesday against Seattle U, but will return to action hosting Wisconsin this weekend. Badgers 6-4 so far in Big Ten play, just behind the Huskies.
Have walked there in 10. That's fine. I don't need to do an aside. I've done enough.
Haven't you done enough? football begins spring practice on Tuesday. Not a lot of updates as yet, but we will continue to monitor the situation. Denzel Boston and
monitor the situation. Ephesians, spring practice.
Denzel Boston and Ephesians Prysock among those not participating fully yet at the start of camp, although they were dressed and available, according to I read Christian Capel's report on Montlake.com.
It's pretty fun. The DeBon Williams season starts now.
Seattle Seahawks news. Uchenna Nwosu reworked his contract to stay in Seattle, accepting a $7 million pay cut this season, but getting $5 million in new incentives to make up for it. John Schneider shared that Nwosu had knee surgery at the beginning of the offseason. It's not yet clear whether he'll be back for the start of the 2025 regular season, which will impact his pursuit of those incentives. Notably, Nwosu also gave up his number 10 to Cooper Kupp, taking Geno Smith's former number 7. So I read this one wrong. I thought that the Seahawks bringing in DeMarcus Lawrence was an indication that they were not going to be bringing back Nwosu, but they will have both of them on the roster for this season. Some contract details. Cooper Kupp's contract, a $12 million sign-in bonus, almost $5 million guaranteed salary this year, but not quite because he's a $5 million set-off with his former Rams contract. So they put it at $4.99 million, right below that amount.
I love it.
His 2026 salary of $13 million is non-guaranteed through February 10th when $9 million becomes guaranteed. That means the Seahawks could move on after one season with $9.5 million cap savings, and they would take an $8 million hit on their 2026 cap if they choose to do so.
So it's going to be a one-year deal. And
I don't think it necessarily
No,
is.
I don't know. But if it were to be a one-year deal, it's a one-year $17 million. Is that right?
Correct.
It's not great.
I think I put this, we talked about it on the pod. I thought $12 million was the appropriate one-year amount for Cooper Kupp at this stage of his career.
Yeah, it's a pretty bad deal that they signed. But I like Cooper Kupp, so whatever.
And it does, you know, structuring it that way does buy them the ability, like the third year, you know, all of a sudden, you know, that you have a lot of flexibility with that.
I do
considerable
think
flexibility in your two.
Still probably has upside to come close to meeting the value of this contract.
For sure. If he's healthy, I think it's plausible. The Sam Darnold contract includes two void years, meaning Darnold's cap hit is just $13.4 million this season. Seahawks would save $8.3 million on the cap by waiving Darnold before February 15th, 2026, barring an injury that causes his $27.5 million 2026 base salary to guarantee. So this sort of reiterates what we already knew from Pro Football Talks reporting, that this could just be a one-year deal for Sam Darnold if the Seahawks decide that he is not their quarterback of the future or of the long term.
A much better deal than the Cooper Kupp deal. Honestly, I'm a little surprised that the Darnold market wasn't better this offseason, given, you know, like the Russell Wilson deal with the Giants. Obviously, it's shorter term, but like apples to apples, you'd probably rather have Sam Darnold than Russell Wilson at this point, right?
Yes.
And then when you factor in that, if that's the case as well, we kind of talked about this with Geno, where it's like Geno may be better than Sam Darnold next year, but if Sam Darnold is good enough, if Sam Darnold seems like it's like, okay, this is a capable, similar to Geno, right? This is a capable starting quarterback in the NFL. We can build a team around him that can compete for the playoffs. Year two, year three, that's when it's really valuable. Right. And I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't a bigger market for Darnold. Honestly, seeing some of the deals that have been signed and the teams that still need quarterbacks overall, you know, knowing what the Steelers are doing right now, seeing the deal that Justin Fields got, Russell Wilson, various teams from New York.
I mean, I think the Russell Wilson deal isn't this big, is it?
But he's much older, and it's not like it's a small amount of money for Russell Wilson.
I suppose.
Like, if you're the Giants, I feel like this deal makes way more sense than bringing Russ in for a season, because it's also like, are they competing
and
this
paying
year?
Both him and Jameis Winston?
Yeah. Are the Giants a playoff competitor with Russell Wilson? Like, obviously not, right? Their over-under is probably 5.5 wins, 6.5 wins.
It seems very unlikely.
So it's kind of just like, what's the plan? So I think the Seahawks managed to find a very good market inefficiency with Darnold. They leveraged, same with that they did with Geno. And when they signed Geno to the extension, they leveraged that the league wasn't ready to accept that he was a starting caliber NFL quarterback yet. And the Seahawks were willing to make that bet, and they got a deal because of it.
All right. Let's talk about some of the players that they have signed since we last podcast. Wide receiver River Craycraft, formerly the Dolphins, WSU product, a 7-year NFL vet. I would never have guessed that.
Wow.
Although, granted, the era with the late Mike Leach at Washington State University is now pretty far in the rearview mirror. Only 32 career NFL receptions for Craycraft, including 7 last season.
I feel like I've seen like half of these receptions.
It's same.
Right?
They've all been
he
on
has
red zone.
32 receptions.
I was shocked.
Right? Don't you feel like it's one place or another, almost always on NFL Red Zone? Just like River Craycraft with the catch. And you're like, hell yeah.
Yeah.
This is how you know that it's deceptively all love between us and the Cougars. And then I was like, all right, River Craycraft, let's go.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
If this was Tez Jones, I'd be like, no, no, thank you, sir. Not interested. Tez Johnson, not Tez Jones.
I was going to say, I don't know who Tez Jones is. I would take Troy Franklin, even though he didn't have a great rookie season.
I would not.
Wide receiver Steven Sims Jr. from the Ravens. He's a return specialist with 78 career receptions, but none in 9 games last season between Houston and Baltimore. Has 74 career punt returns, 62 career kickoff returns. We saw some further modification to the NFL's new kickoff rules for the 2025 season designed to create more returns. So a position the Seahawks certainly needed to address. 49ers tight end Eric Saubert, an 8-year vet who's played for 7 teams, has 47 career catches, played 35% of offensive snaps for the San Francisco, as well as 67% of special team snaps, comes in as the blocking tight end to go along with the returning duo of Noah Fant and, why am I blanking name now on the name of last year's rookie?
AJ Barner?
AJ Barner, of course, the Michigan product.
Love him.
Yeah.
I would have never guessed that Eric Saubert has more career receptions than River Craycraft.
Exactly. Just have not stood out the same way whenever we've been watching those games. Brown safety D'Anthony Bell, a three-year veteran in Cleveland, played just 9% of defensive snaps, but 85% on special teams. It seems like this is something else the Seahawks have been, something the Seahawks have definitely been targeting in free agency, is upgrading their special teams personnel. So Bell, you know, a factor there, and potentially some depth at the safety position, particularly if they move on from Rashawn Jenkins.
Seems like a pretty stupid place to spend money.
I don't think they spent money.
I know. It's like there's so many draft picks that you could upgrade your special teams with. But
I mean,
sure.
He's making $1.1 million.
All right.
I do think there's probably, I mean, you know, there's probably an element of having proven it in the NFL. Most, I mean, I guess college defensive players often will play special teams. So, and then lastly, Saints cornerback Shamar John Charles, who started two games last season and played 23% of defensive snaps. This one just kind of feels like a flyer, I would say. So you'll notice that one position was conspicuously absent in that list, and that's interior offensive line. Seahawks still haven't signed one. John Schneider said at the owners' meetings they likely won't do so until after the draft, when players might be cap casualties. Did say that they hosted a Jaguars restricted free agent, whose name I did not put in my notes. And could be a potential option there.
Cole I'm not Van coming Lennon. Up for that one, like AJ Barner.
No, Brandon, I'm not expecting you to. Cole Van Lannen could be another plausible option once that qualifying
offer.
Well,
they had a visit from Van Lannen.
expires. But Schneider said that it would be difficult to upgrade on the duo of Olu Oluwatimi and Jalen Sundahl, et cetera, and he's optimistic about Christian Haynes' ability to improve in Clint Kubiak's offense. So... does this, you know, we'll see to what degree they're going to address these positions in the draft. But if you're expecting veteran additions, don't.
There will be guards out there. Like
I mean, they will add someone at the Laken Tomlinson level. I don't know when they signed Laken Tomlinson last year.
They will have plenty of time to sign guards. There will be guards at equal to the level of the players that are out there right now that they will be able to sign at some point in the next 6 months.
It was not technically like, after the draft, but they signed him on April 15th last year, like in Tomlinson.
Okay, we've got 12 days. But John told us don't get too excited about your Lake and Tomlinson's of the world before the draft. This is fine. Like, the difference between the Seahawks, that a random, like, $2 million guard is not going to matter for one win, positive or negative.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that Schneider said was like, basically, so why did you have all these interior offensive linemen in for visits and they didn't sign? And he said, like, it could be financial. It could be, you know, basically we think that their personality is not a fit. It could be, you know, we don't think they're right for our coaching staff. So I think people think of it as you're bringing, like, with players of that level, you're not bringing them in for visits because you're like trying to wine and dine them and sign them. You're bringing them in for visits to evaluate them, not the other way around.
Yes. I like all the reasons. It's like Adam Silver talking about expansion.
Oh, I think that Seahawks fans feel about John Schneider in the offensive line similarly to how Sonics fans feel.
They
about
might be
Adam
right,
Silver
but the
expansion.
Thing is, the ship has sailed. Like with the Will Freeze, like when he signed, basically, it was, which I think their process was probably good, but when Will Freeze signed elsewhere, then it was done, more or less, as correct. Far as signing a guard in that territory. They kind of were like, you know, if they didn't have the chance to sign him, he's with the Vikings. And as it is, you're going to be looking at, you know, $1-3 million guards at this point. Those players will be out there later.
Correct. Last bit of Seahawks news, Brady Henderson reported that DK Metcalf has previously requested trades multiple times in recent off seasons before the trade request that was fulfilled with him going to the Steelers. To me, the most significant thing about this is it implies that the trade request wasn't a result of the extension negotiations with the Seahawks. So it wasn't a case of the Seahawks, you know, not valuing DK the way that other teams did or he thought he should be. It was more he was unhappy with a variety of things that he has laid out, including how Tyler Lockett was handled in the offense last season.
Totally wrong. You're totally wrong about this. All of the stuff that's happening right now around DK Metcalf so fucking predictable and so boring to listen to, where people are trying, it's always Heathers in the NFL, right? People are trying to give meaning to the past because of what happened with DK Metcalf and him being traded. The real reason was he didn't want to sign the extension. The Seahawks didn't want to pay him what he asked for, so he was traded to the Steelers. That's it. These trade requests from the past, here, let me tell you who is a happy star NFL receiver. Endless. There are not happy.
I think DK Metcalf's pretty happy right now. He's happy right now because
he just signed the extension. And he was just traded. Give it 5 weeks. Give it even less. How about that? Give it 2 weeks for the Steelers. They're NFL star wide receivers. They're always unhappy. That is the point of the position. And of course, like, the requested a trade, he's unhappy in the locker room. DK Metcalf was fine. He was as happy as every star NFL receiver has ever been. We knew when you have a player like that, it is a time bomb. It is only a matter of time that you're going to have on a team because there's one ball. And every player like DK Metcalf, every star NFL receiver, thinks the ball should be thrown to them. And so when he's not getting that kind of action, of course he's unhappy. But the trade requests and the unhappiness, it's just going back and redefining the past without any reality to it. Of course he was unhappy. And he was also happy because at all times, human beings contain a multitude of emotions. Like the trade request, if it was a legit actual trade request, the Seahawks either would have fulfilled it or we would have known. There's no like secret trade request that DK had. He was just like, hey, I wouldn't mind being traded or whatever. He's like, oh, I'm so pissed. And then the next day he was like, I'm fine. Like that is it. The amount that people are talking about this is so fucking predictable. And when star players change teams,
I don't think people are talking about it that much, for the record.
There's been way more. There's like a podcast that he was on where he was like talking shit. He's like, who cares? Spoiler alert, player who left an NFL team, who requested a trade from an NFL team, is now much happier at their new team and wasn't that happy before. It's like, no fucking shit. That's what you say when you change teams. It happens all the time. In every position. That's it. It is not news.
Well,
this is how people talk about NFL athletes. And when you get to a new team, there are always problems before, but it's perfect now. Just wait till Jimmy Butler demands a trade from the Warriors.
I mean, obviously there are always things that come out after someone gets traded. But
it's not that a thing is coming out. Like, these weren't actually underlying things. There was not a problem with DK Metcalf any more than there was when he was happy or unhappy. I do not buy any
tell you is that the end of his contract coming up gave DK Metcalf a certain different leverage for a trade request than he had before when he was under contract for multiple years. I think you need to consider that possibility.
You always have leverage for a trade request in the NFL. Every day you have
Don't agree with that request. Assessment.
It was just there came a time that the Seahawks set a number. If the Seahawks would have paid DK,
do we know that the Seahawks, has it been reported that the Seahawks even made him an offer?
Maybe not, but they might have been like, hey, the agent, they had a conversation. I guarantee you that Schneider
had
and the
a
Seahawks
conversation, but that conversation might have ended with, yeah, he's not interested in extending.
It might have ended with, here's the number. And John Schneider was like, cool, yeah, we're good. And they were like, all right, well, then trade us. And then they traded him.
Both of those things are possible.
If the Seahawks were willing to have paid DK Metcalf what he wanted to be paid, he would have re-signed in Seattle. I'm sorry, but like, all of this stuff is fucking bullshit. It's stupid.
Well,
it is
untrue
April,
and unfair.
It is April, and we're desperate for the draft to happen. And that's it. People just want football content. None of this matters. None of the DK Metcalf stuff matters. It says nothing about the Seahawks. The Seahawks will be fine. It says nothing about DK Metcalf. It's just, you just put it into, it's like a vertical. The vertical of star NFL wide receiver. DK Metcalf got plopped into the vertical, and then he experienced the entire situation that happened. We know what the rest of his career will look like. They'll be like, he'll be unhappy in Pittsburgh at some point next year. He'll sort of like slowly fade away, and he'll be younger than you actually realize, and will be on the Arizona Cardinals. You're mad because it's true. You're mad because it's true.
Consider that there are limits to your knowledge.
It's actually the Titans. I take that back. It'll be the Tennessee Titans.
Oh, yeah. It's 100% the Titans.
DK Metcalf. It's just like he got plopped into the vertical And it is a matter of time before the wheel swings and all of a sudden DK Metcalf is a Tennessee Titan. And you draft him in like the 10th round of the fantasy draft and you'd be like, he wasn't bad that long ago, maybe. And then all of a sudden you'll release him for your fantasy team in like week 6. We've seen
count?
It.
Does this count as a bold prediction?
It's not a bold prediction. No, I'm telling you, it is a vertical. It is a vertical to jump into. That's what I hate. I hate people being like, oh, this thing is news. It's not news. It is not news.
I disagree with your assessment.
No post-pod talk.
I agree with that assessment. I need to go to bed. I got to record the Hoop Collective.
Tonight?
No.
Wendy's like, he's like, we want the hottest takes come after midnight.
I mean, it is true. Yeah, that would be quite a windy sleep update, though.
The Hoop Collective, after dark.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Ah.